So the title I gave to tonight's Dharma talk is Mindfulness of Mental Formations. And I want to first of all put that title into a little bit of context. The Buddhist teachings on mindfulness are primarily found in something called the Satipatthana Sutta, which is sometimes also called the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And mindfulness of mental formations is the third of those four foundations. So the first two, just to once again give you put a bit of context here, the first two foundations are mindfulness of body in all of its various things through breath and through body sensation and all those sorts of things. And then once mindfulness, the second foundation is mindfulness of Vedana. And Vedana is actually a mental formation, but the Buddha separates it out because it's so important. And gives it great emphasis by separating the whole second foundation is this Vedana. And Vedana is a mental formation that arises directly after any sensation at any of the six sense doors. And basically, it's incredibly simple. It basically only has three forms. The mental formation might seem pleasant, it might be unpleasant, it might be neutral. Or sometimes they say neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Neutral, I think that's just fine. And this is important because when we get to see this Vedana arising, we can then work with not being so reactive to the pleasant, the unpleasant, and the neutral, which is what we usually do, especially when we don't see it. And that's a lot of what the mindfulness of mental formations is all about, really, is this reactive process. So then I also want to talk a little bit about the words mental formations. It seems kind of like klutzy English, right? But it has a certain flavor behind it that I want to make sure you understand. Because you often see this thing, that same third foundation of mindfulness called something like, for instance, mindfulness of thoughts. Well, thoughts are mental formations, but they're not all mental formations. They're just the one, there's like a subset of all mental formations. And you also see it sometimes as a mindfulness of mind states. I think they could be equally good as mental formations, though. Mind states, once again, for me, when I hear the word mind states, it doesn't include moods, for instance, which are also mental formations. You also see this, and this is what Joseph Goldstein uses. Actually, he calls this as mindfulness of mind. So it's just like a very broad, everything to do with the mind, it's all there. I like mental formations because it allows me to sort of, because what's happening is these things are arising, they're forming in a sense in the mind. So it sort of indicates this, there's a process, and we're being aware of the process itself. Okay, so now I actually want to read a little bit from the sutta, just to put this even into more context. So this is the actual instructions in the Satipatthana Sutta, or the beginning of these instructions. There's two sections here, and I'm going to break it into two sections. So this is how the instruction starts. He knows a lustful mind to be lustful, and a mind without lust to be without lust. First of all, lust in this sense is not, are in the Western connotation, lust this always has sort of sexual connotation. Lust just means strong, overwhelming wanting. About you can have lust for ice cream or lust for a new job. I mean, it doesn't have to be, it's a grasping, wanting in the strongest sense. He knows an angry mind to be angry and a mind without anger to be without anger. He knows a deluded mind to be deluded and a mind without delusion to be without delusion. He knows a contracted mind to be contracted and a distracted mind to be distracted. I'm going to stop there and talk about that first. This is sort of the first half of the instructions, and I'll come back to the other half. So these are five general categories of mental formations, right? Lust, anger, delusion, a contracted mind state, and a distracted mind state. The first three, lust, anger, delusion, are direct results of Vedana, particularly when it goes unnoticed. So when we have pleasant Vedana arising, we then tend to react to that Vedana by going towards lust, wanting, oh, I want that, I want more of that because it's so pleasant, right? When it's an unpleasant Vedana, we get anger. Anger, we sometimes see other words there, but anger is a good one, actually. It's like, I don't want that. I don't want that has a tone of anger in your mind and in your voice, even when you say it out loud. And then the third one, delusion, is when things are neutral. When things are neutral, it's like, God, boring, 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 boring. The interesting thing is about 90% of our mental, of the things that arise at our sense doors are totally neutral. We're bombarded by neutral all the time. And so that's why we get, so delusion is something that arises out of that space quite quickly. So those are the first three, right? And these are basically our general reactive patterns to the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. They're sometimes called the three unwholesome mind states, or more harshly, you'll see them sometimes called the three poisons. And think about the word poisons. Poisons are things, something that makes you sick, might even kill you, but makes you really sick. But it's all internal. Poisons are something that's going on internally. It isn't out there in the world. It's inside you somehow. There's poison inside you, which is an interesting image, I think, for what these things are like, because they are all internal whirling in our own part mind. There's a quote from the Dhammapada I like about these three. This is so this is there's no fire like lust, no seizure or grip like anger, and no snare or net like delusion. And these are very descriptive, right? Lust, I want fire, I want it right now. It's like you're on fire for it. You're really, it has that image, right? No seizure or grip like anger. You're seized by anger. You're gripped by anger. Ever feel that when you get upset and angry? How there's a real powerful tightness. It's a grip, right? And then snare or net like delusion. I like this because delusion, the big problem with delusion, and some of you have heard me say this many times, is the big problem with delusion is we're often so deluded we don't know we're deluded. It's just delusion has that quality of, duh, I don't know what's going on. Like we're not aware at all. And that's like a snare or a net. Like a snare or a net is like you're sort of going along in your daily life, and all of a sudden, there you are up on a tree or something, or held down by a net or something like that. It's like that's what happens on the mental level. All of a sudden, we're gone into some space, some story, some fantasy, something that's totally deluded. The next thing to notice about these instructions, so let me, I'll just read one little bit of it here. He knows a lustful mind to be lustful, and a mind without lust to be without lust. Equally important. He doesn't say one's more important than the other. It's just as important to know when we're not in these mind states, these habitual mind states. It's really important that we can be aware and notice, oh, right now, my mind's calm. It isn't on fire. It isn't in its ha I'm not having a seizure or anything. I'm not trapped anywhere. I'm just calm and still. Oh, this is Kind of nice. And this is what encourages us to practice more. When we see that this practice isn't all about just this horrible stuff that's happening all the time, it's also about the calm and the sweet. And the problem is we often don't notice that because we're so busy looking for what's wrong. And we and the danger of this practice, being mindful of our mind states, our mental formations, is we can turn this into this really sophisticated, spiritual way to beat ourselves up. Oh, I'm so full of lust and anger, and I'm so deluded, and we tell ourselves these stories about how we're just no good, and blah 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 blah. And the practice reinforces those ideas in a sense, because that's what we're seeing. Because we're not paying attention to the wholesome when the wholesome arises. Because we're so busy looking for what's wrong. Partly this is genetic. It's like basically, down at the brain stem level of our brain, we were grew up in a world, 10,000 years ago out there on the plains, where, with our little tribe maybe, where we had to be watchful all the time. Some animal's going to come and eat us, or some other tribe's going to come and attack us, or you're always like sort of aware and worried. And that's sort of how we're hardwired to be that way. And so we have to consciously train ourselves not to go there so often. Not to be caught in that habitual pattern that's really deeply ingrained. And instead start to consciously see the wholesome. The one of the best ways, this is something I try and do a lot actually, in terms of actually being able to notice when I'm not, is when you're caught in a storm of something, pick your favorite poison, right? And you're caught in that storm of it. At some point, because all things that arise end, it ends. And if you can be aware of at what it's like at the end, it's like, oh, this is kind of nice. Just right there, you can notice the wholesomeness of it being gone. Just that is a good start, just to notice when you're caught in an unwholesome mind state, and then it's gone, and the wholesomeness arises right there. I mean, if it's not, it's like, oh, here's this wholesome stuff. Isn't this nice? Even if it's like kind of neutral and calm and pretty flat, it's not caught up in the drama of an unwholesome mind state. As unwholesome, all of these things, the lust, anger, delusion, all have drama involved with them, of course, too. Some they have we have stories we tell ourselves about this happened and that happened, or this might happen, or whatever. And sure enough, we're reliving those things, or worried about something that's going to be happening in the future, and we get caught up in that story, and that's how we just reinforce that mind state, that mental formation. We feed it because we're not paying attention. The other thing is about these is when we notice them, we have to be really careful not to go to self-blame, because now we're just adding another layer of suffering on top of what's already there. And it's so easy to go, oh, it's me. I'm full of lust yet again. Oh no, I'm so lustful. And it's also how we create our sense of a separate self. I'm the one who's always lustful. I'm the one who's always angry. I'm the one who is that never sees these things until it's too late and I'm caught up in the whirlwind of them. This is what we do. We create a sense of ourself as the person who isn't any good. And the other thing about these mental formations when they arise, if we get caught by them on the mental level, if we get sort of caught in the story, if we're not careful, especially in terms of fantasy about the future or memories about the past sometimes too, we then start to act from that energetic place. We start to act in unwholesome ways based on these unwholesome mind states. If they're just mind states and we're noticing them, that's well, we can work with that. But once you start acting in the world based on these mind states, now we're causing way more suffering, not only for ourselves, but for everyone around us. That's the unhappy story part of these mental formations as they arise. I want to read a little bit more from this. This book I'm reading from is called Satipatthana by Anilayo. And so this is basically Anilayo's PhD thesis at a university in Sri Lanka on the Satipatthana Sutta. So it's a bit dense, shall we say, but it's wonderful because it has he just has great insight. And since he's talking about working skillfully with mental formations, it is noteworthy that contemplation of the mind does not involve active measures to oppose unwholesome states of mind, such as lust or anger. It's an interesting thought, right? It's like it's not about opposing them, not about fighting them. Rather, the task of mindfulness is to remain receptively aware by clearly recognizing the state of mind that underlines a particular train of thought or reactions. Such uninvolved receptivity is required because of one's instinctive tendency to ignore whatever contradicts or threatens one's sense of importance and personal integrity. The habit of employing self-deception to maintain one's self-esteem has often become so ingrained that the first step to developing accurate self-awareness is honest acknowledgement of the existence of hidden emotions, motives, and tendencies of the mind, without immediately suppressing them. Maintaining non-reactive awareness in this way counters the impulse towards either a reaction or suppression contained in unwholesome states of mind, and thereby deactivates their emotional and intentional pull. So he's saying, all you need to do is be aware that this is what's arisen. If we take that sort of definition, that combination of mindfulness is paying attention to what's arisen, well, this is what's arisen. That's all. This is what's arisen, and we're being aware of it. We don't have to judge it. We don't have to judge ourselves. We don't have to blame ourselves. We just have to retain, be receptive, and say, ah, anger has arisen, and that's okay. And it's that second part, and that's okay. That's is the difficult part because we're so it's so easy to get reactive to these things because they're so, especially when they're strong. It's so easy to fall into those reactive patterns instead. And really, that the task of mindfulness, as he says, is just simply to pay attention. This is what's arisen. Now they're not a problem. They're just what has arisen, and now I'm just being mindful of them. We make them into a problem. They're not a problem in and of themselves. It's not like we're supposed to be these pure, perfect human beings that never, ever experience lust and anger and delusion. That's not the object of this practice at all. It's because that's unrealistic for a start. What the object of this practice is just to be aware of it. Just to see it for what it is. Oh, it's just that. It's my old friend, anger. And then it takes their power away, in a way, just by being this non-reactive awareness. Anyhow, Also, I want to read. This is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. He has something to say about this too, which I think is important. Different voices. And he's talking about this mindfulness of mental formations from a slightly different angle, which I think is also quite useful. And he, this little section in his book is called What is Skillful and What is Not? By emphasizing the recognition of knowing of the unwholesome roots and the wholesome ones in their absence, the Buddha is highlighting the wise discernment of what is skillful and what is unskillful. That is, discerning what leads to happiness and liberation and what leads to suffering. Although this discernment is basic to the Buddha's teachings, in our Western culture, it's a very delicate process. For many people, it's an easy step from recognizing a particular mind state like greed or hatred as being unwholesome to the feeling that you're a bad person for having it, or that somehow it's wrong for the mind state to even arise. This pattern of reaction simply leads to more self-judgment, more aversion, and more suffering. It's not a helpful cycle. It's important to understand which mind states are skillful and which are unskillful, not in order to judge ourselves or be reactive to them, but in order to see which leads to happiness and should be cultivated in our lives, and which leads to suffering and should be abandoned. By cultivating, I love that word, it's used a lot in these teachings. Like we can consciously set about creating causes and conditions so it's more likely that a wholesome mind state will arise than an unwholesome one. We can't control what's arising right in this moment, but we can cultivate, which implies work, you know, cultivating is work, effort, so that it's less likely that unwholesome mind states will arise again in the future. Because we're creating through our cultivation wholesome causes and conditions. The distinction between wholesome and unwholesome mind states brings a moral dimension into psychology. This is particularly important because these different states are not only arising in our minds, they are also what motivates our actions. So there's Joseph repeating what I was saying earlier. Or me, probably me repeating Joseph actually, but it's like it's a really important thing that these strong and wholesome mind states, mental formations that we're talking about, they're what often motivate our actions. And those actions can be quite unskillful and quite harmful. So we have to be aware of that. I have a little note here. It says, this sounds easy, but it isn't. Because for all of them, or most of our life, we've been identifying with these defilements. They're often how we define ourselves, think of ourselves. They're how we create a separate I. And they are also deeply, deeply embedded reactive patterns. How this is how we've been reacting over and over and over again when we haven't been mindful of these things, which is most of our life probably, and to be honest with us ourselves, probably most of our daily life too. You know, we're often not very skillful in our day-to-day life, and this is encouraging us to be skillful in our day-to-day life as well. So then after those three, the Buddha says we should know when the mind's contracted and when the mind's distracted. What do those two things mean? So contracted means a lack of energy, an inability to connect with what's happening. So, you know, this sometimes is called sloth and torpor, but it's like it's contracted. It's like the mind is like we can't sort of reach out and grab onto anything. We can't see anything clearly at all. We're just sort of in a fog. You know, we've pulled back from the moment-to-moment experience. Distracted is the opposite. It's the mean this mind is jumping all over the place, a lack of focused concentration. So one is passive and the other is overactive. And what we have to do is find a balance between these two. If we're in this contracted mind state, think about a contracted mind state is it can sometimes seem quite pleasant. It's like, oh yeah, I'm so calm and still. And you're just like lost in la la land, but it seems that, oh, I'm really focused, right? But you're just, it's a form of delusion, right? It's like we're deluded into thinking things are great when actually we're just not paying attention at all. Or we're being what I've seen called sort of mindful. A little bit of, once in a while I might notice something, but most of the stuff is just sort of drifting on by. And the opposite, that the distracted, it's like, it's so unpleasant to be really distracted, like you're jumping around, you can't, there's nothing still and focused about anything that's going on at all. The other thing about, now we've got five things, right? We've got lust, anger, delusion, contracted, distracted. All of these sort of might be called moods. I think the mood is a good word here. Because think about a mood. A mood is sort of this underlying sort of flavor to what's going on in the heart mind. It isn't something precise that we can sort of stick our finger on, but it's there. And these are also mental formations. Moods are distinct mental formations. They tend to draw themselves out. So it's a thought. Some more from Joseph Goldstein here. He's talking again about distracted and contracted. So I think once again it's good to have different words. The next instruction in this contemplation of mind are to know contracted mind is contracted and distracted mind is distracted. Contracted here refers to the inner withdrawal of the mind due to sloth and torpor. There's little or no energy to meet the object. We experience dullness and heaviness, collapsing inward. This state is contrasted with the mind distracted by externals and pursuing different sense objects due to restlessness. There is an interesting progression of the instruction in this section of the sutta on mindfulness. First, we develop awareness of the three wholesome and unwholesome roots, becoming mindful of them so that the mind remains free and unattached. Next, the Buddha says to be mindful of both of the contraction of mind and the distraction of mind. By not getting lost in or becoming identified with either of these states, the mind then finds the balance necessary for deeper concentration and the higher states of mind that follow. What is reassuring to all of these instructions is that they fully acknowledge the difficulties that arise in practice. It's not somehow we need to be free of all the hindrances and defilements in order to proceed. Here the Buddha is saying that mindfulness of all these states when they arise is itself the path to freedom. Repeat that sentence. But here the Buddha is saying that mindfulness of all these states when they arise is itself the path to freedom. Through bare attention and mirror-like wisdom, we see their ephemeral, impermanent, and selfless nature. This itself is sufficient for liberation. I find those words very encouraging. So, how can we work with these mental formations when they arise? Well, number one, first one, number one, number one, number one. It's to be mindful, to actually see them when they've arisen. That's always the first step, just to be aware that that's what's going on, right? And sometimes it's, you're practicing, and it's sort of like kind of fuzzy, and it's not clear what's going on. Drop a little question into your mind. Actually, consciously drop something like, "What's happening?" or "What's going on?" Not expecting an answer, at least not a long discursive answer, but sometimes just dropping that little question into the mental spinning helps clarify things. That can often be a very skillful thing to do, to just nudge the mind mental process a little bit by dropping a simple little question like this, not expecting an answer, and maybe it'll work and maybe it won't, but this is like skillful means. This is one particular skillful means that I've found quite useful at times, just to sort of drop that little question right into the mind stream at that point when things aren't clear, like, what the heck's going on here? Well, let's ask the question. And sometimes, oh, now I see, is what the result of that process is. And so this is like part of that is also learning to trust your intuition. Like it'll be like, things just don't feel right now. Oh, what's happening? So it's your intuition telling you, hey, take a closer look here. Number two, and this is always useful, is when we get caught in one of these mental formation storms, which is how I think of them sometimes. They're like, I don't know if you've ever had that feeling. It's like, my God, I'm in this mental whirlwind is going on, right? Oh my God. Is just consciously drop down into the body and pay attention to what's going on in the body as opposed to what's going on at the level of mind. Which is, in a sense, like you're taking a little step back from paying attention to this whirlwind of chaos and going, well, what? Here's something I can actually pay attention to and be mindful of. Oh, look, my body feels really tense or hot or blah, 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 whatever it is. And it's like sort of directing the mind towards the body, which is a skillful place to be mindful. Be mindful of what's actually rising at the body level. You can give yourself enough space to see what's happening. To go, oh, I see. Oh, whenever I get angry, I always feel this tension in my gut. But now I'm actually paying attention to the tension in my gut. Oh, that's what's going on. So it's like it's a feedback loop that you can get out of consciously choosing to pay attention to the body, which is why mindfulness of body is always the first thing that's taught, because it really helps us when we get to this place and start dealing with the mental formations. And I'm going to repeat myself here. Remember not to blame yourself. Really, really important. Remember not to sort of go think there's something wrong. I'm doing something wrong. I'm not pure. I have all this horrible stuff coming arising in my mind. Oh, no, actually, this think of it as, oh, look at that, I'm a human being. Isn't that interesting? Might be a much more effective thought than anything else. Just acknowledge your own humanity. This is what having a heart mind involves. Okay, so that's that first section. But there's another whole section to these instructions. And I want to read this section as well. This is after he's talked about distracted and contracted. He says, he knows a great mind to be great and a narrow mind to be narrow. He knows a surpassable mind to be surpassable, and an unsurpassable mind to be unsurpassable. He knows a concentrated mind to be concentrated, and an unconcentrated mind to be unconcentrated. He knows a liberated mind to be liberated, and an unliberated mind to be unliberated. And when I first time I read this, I'm sure if you haven't ever read this before, your mind's going, wow. You mean I have to pay attention to that? But that's what he's saying here. And I actually find this quite encouraging, is that these are all, what he's talking about now is higher mind states, higher forms of concentrated mind and liberation itself. And what's interesting is that we can be mindful of these mind states. These are mental formations, just like these are things that arise. These are mental formations, just like anger and lust and greed. These are mental formations that arise given the correct causes and conditions. And we can be mindful of them. We can pay attention to them. And one of the definitions of right effort, of course, is when a wholesome mind state has arisen, do whatever you can to maintain that wholesome mind state. Well, if you're not mindful of them, you're not going to be able to pay attention to them and maintain them. So this is really important that you actually be mindful and see these things as well. So you have to be aware of what's happening, as opposed to sinking into the pleasantness of the mind. That's what often happens. It's these mind states, these more concentrated, deeper mind states are so pleasant. It's very easy to sort of sink into them and go, I'll just hang out here, contracted mind. Or it's like, wow, this is happening, this is amazing. We get all excited, and now we're into restless mind instead. We've become distracted by the amazingness of it all. These are both things we have to watch for. When these wholesome mind states arise, we don't want to sort of sink into them, but we don't want to get all excited, because these are just things that arise. These are just mental formations that arise, that are there for a while, and they're gone, just like everything else. They just happen to be kind of interesting and more productive, perhaps, sometimes. So, well, what did he hit all these interesting words? So you have to know a great mind to be great. So, calm, great means calmness that radiates outward. So, this is like you're in a state of loving kindness or compassion. This is like the Brahma Vihara is active. It's like you're actually experiencing. At the level of mental formation that this incredibly wholesome mind state has arisen and is radiating outwards, because the Brahma Viharas are outward radiating. Surpassable, realizing that even though a certain deep level of concentration has arisen, there's more to come. So this is like, you've reached a certain level of deep concentration, but it can go deeper. And this is like, there's something called jhana states, and there's four stages to jhanas. And as you become more skillful in learning to work with these, you'll start to see how they progress. So an unsurpassable mind is a mind that's actually functioning from the level of fourth jhana, which is the very extremely deep concentration. And then the word concentrated he uses here in this context means both calm and experiencing insight. So seeing clearly from a very calm, still place. And liberated means liberated, right? But we don't talk about that, because we have to be careful what we think about the word liberated itself. And this is first of all from Analaya. The theme underlying the contemplation of these four higher states of mind is the ability to monitor the more advanced stages of our meditative development This way, within the scope of contemplation of the mind, sati can range, mindfulness can range from recognition of the presence of lust or anger to awareness of the most lofty and sublime types of mental experience. Each time, with the same basic task of calmly noticing what is taking place. There's the key. Calmly noticing what is taking place. Even when these higher mind states are there, it's like, oh, that's there now. Isn't that interesting? That's okay. Joseph Goldstein also has something to say about this. I want to share as well. In the last line of these teachings, the Buddha says to know the liberated mind as liberated and the unliberated mind as unliberated. Liberated here means both full awakening when all the unwholesome tendencies have been uprooted, but also the mind temporarily free of defilements, a state we often experience in Vipassana practice. Given the propensity to focus on the hindrances and defilements and difficulties, this is a good reminder to notice those times when the mind is free of greed and lust, free of aversion and ill will, free of bewilderment and delusion. We can notice the ease and purity of the mind in these moments of simple, bare attention, when we're aware without clinging, without condemning, and without judging. As one Tibetan teacher described the practice of liberation, short moments, many times. I love that's the so, because what Joseph is pointing to here is liberation isn't like an on-off switch. We all have liberated moments. If we're practicing, we all have those moments. And all we're trying to do is make those moments a little longer and more frequent. And the way to do that is to actually see what it's like in those moments when we actually feel that way, when we feel just calm and still and focused. It's a liberated moment. Be aware of that. Acknowledge that that's what's going on and how great it feels, how wholesome it feels. It's really important that we acknowledge that that's a possibility. Okay. There's one more thing I want to point out about this, these mental formations. In the Satipatthana Sutta, after each section, there's a what's called the refrain, which is actually repeated 13 times. So to me, it's always said, wait, 13 times is probably important if he keeps repeating it this much. And there's a part of what he says is we should be aware of these things we're being paying attention to, both internally and externally. So we have to pay attention not only what's arising at the level of our own mind, heart, mind, but also what's arising in those around you. This is really important in day-to-day life. Or mindfulness, as opposed to when we're sitting with our eyes closed. But even then, sometimes when you're sitting with your eyes closed, you can sort of, if you're sitting with a group of people, a system with people you've known for a while, you sort of feel things going on around you. Just there's something going on there, and that's being and it's okay to be mindful of that external energy. Perfectly all right. Whether that external energy is really restless or it's really calm and still and focused. I remember one retreat, I sat next to this person for a month, didn't know her name, didn't know anything about her, but by the end of the month, it was like, I actually said to her, because we had a little chance to talk right at the end of the retreat, I said, it was so nice sitting next to you because I could just feel your steady, calm space. And it was just so encouraging for me to feel that. And she wrote, yeah, with him. And it's just like, so we have to tune into those external things. But also just in our day-to-day lives of like hanging out with people. how much better are we going to be interacting with other people if we can tune into where they're at mentally? Oh, this, we tune in and we see that this person's kind of angry. Well, telling them not to be angry is going to be pretty useless. Probably just make them angrier, as a matter of fact. But if we can just know that's what's there, then we can sort of modify how we interact with them so that we don't make it worse for them. We don't amp it up. We can be calm, we can be still, we can be focused. We can be open-hearted, we can be full of loving kindness for them because they're suffering. And this is like a conscious choice we can make in our day-to-day interactions with people. So this is being mindful of mind states externally. And this is how we take this practice out into the world and apply it out in the world. And I think it's a place which is important. And also, the other thing that this does, when we start being mindful of others externally, we start to see, if we look at the things from the point of mindfulness, oh, all these people are going through exactly the same stuff I go through all the time. We're not different at all. We're not separate at all. We seem separate because we have these different bodies that look different. But that's all that's going on. It's just, it makes us feel closer to everyone else because we tune into them and not, and of course, because we're tuned in and not being reactive to them, then we can really feel our heart connections to them instead. And that's what's, I think, so important. So, as usual, I have a piece of poetry to reflect all this. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. And this is a poem, rather longer poem for her, called The Fruits of Practice. It describes very clearly what practice is like, I think. Despite fervent pleas for ease and safety, there are many days when reality doesn't quite line up with what I'd choose. Breakdown, letting go, surrendering even the illusion of control, breathing into the unknown. Sometimes that's what life holds. Practice hasn't brought an end to pain. I still increase my suffering like a fish caught on a line. My struggles only draw the hook in deeper. But being in reality is its own reward. It's the perfect paradox. The courage to stand and breathe when everything in me wants to flee is as great a gift as the freedom to seek retreat. No, practice hasn't brought an end to pain. But as it has honed my willingness to experience the moment and sometimes see perfection unfolding in ways I wasn't big enough to plan, much less predict. Practice isn't about achieving a goal. It's not a means to pole vault over suffering. Practice is a way of looking life in the face and saying yes to all its disparate gifts. Practice keeps me awake when I would sleep and reminds me it's the journey unfolding in this very moment. It's the journey that reveals the truth and not the destination.